With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iskov. And with me today is Scott Casuccio, motion graphics artist, a musician. He has a, it's not a band, but what would you call it? Some sort of a...
I guess you'd call it like a recording project where I don't
sure.
have to use my real name.
Right. It's called Letters End. It's on all streaming sites. It's on Bandcamp as well. I highly, highly recommend everybody check it out. It is, and I'm not just saying this because I've known Scott for over 20 years and he's a good friend, but it is tremendous music that everybody should check out. So please do that. He's also here because when I came to the conclusion that I wanted to do an episode on The Fragile, there was really no one else that I could imagine talking to about Nine Inch Nails for at least 90 minutes, is Scott. And because I feel like, I mean, they're one of your favorite bands, I'm assuming. I'm going to put that, they're up there. You're a fan, let's just say that. But I think that they're a band I associate with you. And I say that with obviously nothing but love. But also considering this musical project of yours, Letters End, which obviously I recently listened to, it feels like the way that Trent Reznor approaches music is similar in some ways to the way that you approach music. That there's sort of this deconstructive kind of component, this idea of sort of manipulating noises, instruments, what have you, and sort of bending things to your will musically in some way or another. Is that a completely insane thing to say, or do you think that that's an accurate?
No, I mean, I think with my own music, where I'm at right now is the struggle between the fact that I write everything on like an acoustic guitar primarily. But then with like half of the stuff I've released so far, which is a really small output, I've been working a lot on, you know, putting out maybe a full album, hopefully early in the coming year. But, you know, when I leave the songs alone and keep them stripped back, then it's more akin to like traditional singer-songwriter type stuff. Sure. But when I spend more time on it, which like the first couple of songs I put out, definitely there's this inclination. And I started recording music on my computer in the late 90s using software that like doesn't even really exist anymore. Nine Inch Nails was definitely a huge influence on that, because when it came to more electronic stuff at the time, that was my main sort of reference point. Was Nine Inch Nails and, you know, like a bit of Depeche Mode and a bit of other industrial and, you know, that kind of early new wave stuff as well. but I mean, they were a really strong influence, especially if you're talking about like the early mid 90s. And I find that when I've worked on some of my stuff now, like there's a tendency to look for those sounds, to have that distorted, grungy, things falling apart sort of sound where, and I've worked some of that in, and I put out like one on like a whim, like a sort of like a gothy, Leonard Cohen cover. When I had like a few hours and I was like, I'm just going to do this as though it was like, yeah, like an early 80s
sure.
gothy sort of thing. And, that definitely scratched a bit of that itch.
So I'm going to ask a potentially stupid question now, before we go back and talk a little bit about 1999, but I want to sort of, so I just did an episode on, with a friend of mine, Pete, on Moby's Play, which was a very big album in 1999. And I guess my question to you is, electronic music, you know a lot more about it than me, or at least sort of its nascent kind of its growth throughout sort of musical history. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason I bring up Moby is because it does feel like it was a big kind of fulcrum point for electronic music to a certain degree in terms of the mainstream, in terms of it breaking through. Now, he's obviously much more dance oriented, and I'm not really suggesting that Trent Reznor and Moby have a whole lot in common other than David Bowie.
Ties a lot of people together. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But my question is more about sort of fundamentally electronic manipulation of music and how it's advanced and changed, and how these two guys, in their own very different ways, really pushed electronic music into very different directions. Like, to say that Nine Inch Nails is a band in its own way feels a little disingenuous, since it's really a Trent Reznor project. And
yeah,
there are a bunch of members, and I'm certainly not going to go through the revolving door of people that were part of this band, because it's not really worth it, as talented as all those people very well might be. Yeah. It feels like, you know, like I'm always brought back to the image of Trent Reznor destroying a keyboard on stage. Like, that to me feels like the image of the band, right? It's someone who is trying to literally destroy music.
Yeah, it was violent for sure. Especially those like early 90s, mid 90s shows. I was not allowed to go to see Nine Inch Nails and Bowie when they toured in like 96 or something like that, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Because my brother, my oldest brother, who got me into Nine Inch Nails when I was like really young, he had his shoulder dislocated in a mosh pit at a Nine Inch Nails show in like 93 or 94. And so to my mom, that meant, no, there's no chance you're going to that. And I was, you know, living in like the suburbs of Toronto at the time. It wasn't the kind of thing where it was just like, you know, I'm going to walk down the street and go see them. It's like, It was more of a to do. So yeah, I never actually like saw them in those.
Payday.
In their, I'd say their most essential period.
Yeah. I mean, I've only seen them once. I was given a gift by an agent at UTA many years ago for helping him get his parents into some sort of talk show or something like that in the audience. Because I was working in the alternative department at the time. And he kindly gave me two very good tickets to see Nine Inch Nails at the Hollywood Bowl, which was an incredible show. You know, we should talk a little bit as well about sort of there's a very strong visual component to Nine Inch Nails as well, not just in terms of their touring and their concerts, but just, you know, Trent is very specific about the way that the band is put out into the world. Their merchandise, everything is very, very specific.
I mean, down to the, I mean, like when I first started listening to them, the cataloging of things, which, you know, like the Halo 1, Halo 2, all of that stuff. Yep. It also like really reminded me of the way Factory Records used to like FACO 1 and FACO 2, like these became like these, you almost wanted to like collect all of these different things. Cause there was all like the early singles from Pre-Hate Machine and then the, you know, all like the videos that were like sort of bootlegs, but sort of official, like that you couldn't really see anywhere else. And all of that came down to this image and this, you know, it was kind of like you were in on this secret, and because it was so different from the mainstream at the time, even though, I mean, obviously Downward Spiral was a massive, massive hit. Just before that and just after that, like, I think it took a while for it to really seep into the mainstream, but it had this underground sort of, illicit thing, like component to it that was, you know, for a young guy at the time was very attractive, especially just getting into that scene more and more.
Well, it feels like, you know, one of the main sort of, it's no surprise that Trent Reznor and David Fincher work together a lot. They both sort of, there's a currency to contraband with them. This idea of you're getting something you shouldn't, you're seeing something you shouldn't, you're breaking the rules by listening to our music or watching our movies or whatever the case might be. And that obviously was catnip in the 90s when, you know, you had obviously the grunge movement, you had the sort of anti-establishmentarianism that was really kind of seeping into, I mean, had always been there when it comes to teens and people in their early 20s and what have you, but they were really lighting a fire under these people. And I don't say these people in a derogatory sense, just, you know, this idea of feeling disconnected, that, I mean, we all go through adolescence and we all go through this time when we're just unsure of who we want to be in the world. And I mean, some might argue that, you know, Trent still might not be exactly where he wants to be, but I think that he, you know, certainly grappled with a lot of inner angst and turmoil that, similar to a Kurt Cobain or what have you, tapped or hit a vein for a large swath of people in around the world. So in 99, you're at Ryerson with me.
Yep.
So, but are you eagerly anticipating this album as much as it felt like everybody else was? I mean, this was a 7 years between, I believe. Is it 7 or 5 years?
It's five. I think it's 5 years between that and the Downward Spiral.
Yeah.
But there was obviously a lot. He did a lot in between that.
Yeah.
That wasn't like a you know, proper album.
Yeah.
I probably bought it the day it came out.
Sure.
And I was probably super, like, excited. Like, I remember a few moments, you know, like in the 90s where it was like albums coming out was like the biggest deal. Like, I remember, and I'm sure you can relate to this, when Melancholy came out, like, I remember on CFNY, which was the Toronto alternative music station. Yep. I remember them playing like this little snippet of Bullet with Butterfly Wings on like an ad for the album, and like listening to that recorded snippet, because that was like all you could get of it at the time.
Yep.
Like, it was a very much more innocent time. By the time 99 comes around, though, like, being at Ryerson, being in university for a year at that point, because this came out in, like, I think September,
Yeah, September, October, something like that. Yeah.
You become exposed to, like, in high school, I was in like sort of a bubble in terms of my musical taste. Like, there was not many people who, you know, listened to what I listened to. And when you get to university, obviously that opens up, and, you know, we're in like an essentially like an art school. Like, you guys were all in film. Mm-hmm. Jan and I were in, you know, new media, studying how to be who knows what.
Motion graphics artists, I think.
No, we were learning how to be. And there's actually a tie-in to the Nine Inch Nails tour that followed The Fragile. But, you know, we were learning how to be like installation artists and video artists and stuff that no one should ever try to make a living at. But all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm friends with you and with Jan and with Will and with Phil or with Simon. And, you know, you start meeting people who share some of your music taste, but then who have this whole other bunch of music that you've never heard of, and you've got stuff that they've never heard. And so you start to expand. So the stuff that you were listening to before that, and especially with that kind of gap between Downward Spiral, it probably fell a little bit off my radar to a point. But I was obviously like super excited when it came out.
You're not alone in the sense that it seemed like everyone was eagerly anticipating the follow-up to Downward Spiral. 5 years is a very long time between albums. And to your point, there's a whole lot of things that are going to fill the vacuum. You know, I think that this is... You know, having worked in an agency, there's nothing worse than going away for too long, because then all of a sudden you're forgotten about, and you have to sort of work your way back in and fight for relevancy. And the 5 years that Nine Inch Nails went away, a lot of things happened in the music industry that greatly shifted things. But I want to talk about something. You mentioned melancholy, which I think is a really interesting touchstone, because I think that the idea of the double album, the idea of two discs of music, or at least enough music that it doesn't fit on one side, I guess, or on you know, one album, is rarefied air. You know what I mean? Generally speaking, the level of success required in order to validate putting out a double album is, you know, is pretty rare. I would also say too that some albums should be double albums and some albums should be two albums. Trent has subsequently said that he kind of wished that he split The Fragile into two albums, a la Kid A and Amnesiac or something along those lines. and I tend to agree with him a little bit. It's a lot to digest.
It's long. Yeah.
It's fucking long. It's 103 minutes. I mean, that is a long, long album.
103 or 100 and...
I think it's 103 minutes. It's something along those lines.
An hour and 44 minutes.
Yeah, so that works out to about 103 minutes. But anyway, I think that it's a dare of an album in its own way, right? Like, it's basically saying, you know, I want you to spend a large amount of time inside my head as I deal with any number of mental issues, which we'll talk about as we get deeper into this. But I bring this up because I sort of say, like, you know, Melancholy is an example of, like, that's a quote unquote worthy double album. I think that a lot of people, I love that album. It holds up for me. The Wall, any number of other great sort of magnum opuses, if you will. This to me is sort of a bit of both worlds. I think that if you sit down with a pair of headphones and lie on your couch or whatever and listen to this in sequence, it's a tremendous journey. It's just a hard one to go on. And I think that that's why he feels like maybe he should have broken it up.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's any double album out there besides, I mean, even like London Calling, there's like one track on that I'll skip. But I mean, Melancholy for sure, there's a few tracks that even at the time I didn't listen to.
Yep.
Like, there's only so much of like a 9 minute, I think it was XYZ was the name of the track. It was just I get it, but I don't need to listen to this again.
Yeah, I hear that.
And like The Fragile, I realized that, like, I mean, I'm sure I listened to it a good number of times at the time, but it didn't stick with me. And I think that's because it should have been parceled out. And I think some of it, you know, could have been cut entirely.
Sure.
It's definitely two different concepts. There's two really main threads that it follows. And one is that is the more instrumental stuff, which I think resonates now better than the other side, which is there's a lot of like poppy sort of hooks on on the more vocal forward tracks, the singles, and then a couple other ones that I don't think are as successful as the instrumental stuff on this album.
It will surprise no one that this album feels a little bipolar at times, right? Like it does definitely feel as though it's vacillating between a bunch of different ideas. It feels like the person that was making it, which is a person who is unsure how to follow up something that was so unbelievably successful.
Yeah.
That success has led him to question if he's even any good at this. Like, is this what he wants to be doing? And then on top of this, the money and then the drugs. So like all of this and the drinking, I imagine as well. So like
all the exhaustion of touring and stuff like that.
And the exhaustion, right? So it's like, it feels like a maelstrom of sort of emotional insecurity and frustration and depression and angst. Like it's all there. It's really powerful, but you mentioned the instrumental stuff, which, I mean, obviously Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross now are hugely successful composers. Yeah. Just recently I just watched Soul, where it's a beautiful score, not a score that I would have ever imagined that Disney Pixar would have a Trent Reznor Atticus Ross score, and here we are.
So what does it sound like? Is it because they did the score for Mank, which you would not have heard that and said, oh, that's Trent Reznor.
Correct.
Whereas, Social Network or Watchmen, like you hear that and it's like, this is clearly Trent Reznor. Yeah.
This, I would say that, it primarily is the score to, and this gives nothing away, but to The Afterlife, which again, not the jazz stuff. They get into their drones, they get into their kind of bleeps and bloops, and at the same time, and this is something I kind of want to talk about with Trent too. The guy knows how to fucking do a hook. Like he knows how to make a pop song.
For sure.
So there's definitely that infused into Soul as well of just sort of like the levity and the poppiness and the necessary kind of like up that's necessary for a fucking Disney Pixar film. It's really beautiful. I can't wait for you to see the film just in general, but also for you to hear the music. But the instrumental stuff on Fragile, is this, and you'll know better than I do, is this the first time that Trent is dipping his toe into instrumental waters, or has he done that before? Okay.
Definitely not. When you talk about like remixes and stuff like that, a lot of the remixes he did for Downward Spiral Suffer, and even there is one pure instrumental track on Downward Spiral without any vocals at all, which has always been one of my favorite songs on that, A Warm Place, which is very much sounds like early, like Brian Eno's sort of pop stuff. It has that sort of sound to it. And then with remixes, there've definitely been huge instrumental swaths. And at the end of the Downward Spiral, there's, like Eraser and stuff like those tracks that are more spaced out, not really heavy on vocals.
It does feel like, so much of Trent Reznor's work feels like a mood, right? Like it feels like it's a lot of tone poems in its own way. And I don't say that obviously in a negative sense. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not a surprise that he works with someone like David Lynch, who goes out of his way to conjure moments that make you feel something.
Yeah.
Now, what you're feeling is almost irrelevant to him in some way or another. He just wants to elicit an emotion, and his stuff is sort of this visceral, dreamlike stuff.
Yeah.
So the marriage of those two makes total sense to me as well.
And speaking of instrumentals and David Lynch, and we both watched that Song Exploder episode where he, you know, specifically mentions that he wanted to do what David Lynch was doing with, I mean, David Lynch as a sound designer is, I mean, so essential, obviously, to his work and his...
So unnerving.
it's, I mean, it's why you can have a shot of a staircase in Twin Peaks and be so upset, you know? you're looking at like an empty living room and you're like, oh my God, something horrible is going to happen. And it's just this needling that he does with these quiet, like, undertones, these little things just bubbling up. And so the instrumental track on the Lost Highway soundtrack, Driver Down, I think it's called, is again, an instrumental track that it's not easy to have an instrumental track that has like a pop hook to it. Mm-hmm. Like that used to be way more common, obviously in like the '50s with like the Ventures and Link Ray and stuff like that, where you had these instrumental tracks that almost had like, they had like a hook that you wanted to listen to, like it was a catchy chorus. Mm-hmm. And Trent Reznor can definitely do that. Mm-hmm. Like that instrumental track on Lost Highway, which I think is probably the best thing he did in between. Like it's important to note that as something in between Downward Spiral and The Fragile is him. I guess he's the producer on that, but he also did, you know, he had The Perfect Drug from that and the video for that. And then, the work he did on the soundtrack itself, which is for me, like definitely my favorite movie soundtrack, and hugely impactful. I mean, like that opening David Bowie song is like so iconic. You've got an amazing Lou Reed song on there. You've got the Marilyn Manson stuff.
Yeah. And there's a Smashing Pumpkins song I love on there too.
Smashing Pumpkins, which is again, heavily featured in the movie as mm-hmm. well. That was like a big deal as well, I think.
I think it's really interesting what you're, I think it's worth noting, you know, the work of Lynch and Trent together, it really does feel like there's this sort of, they both sort of, there's this confluence of nature and technology, you know, this very kind of strange, I mean, there's lots of, I feel like Lynch has a lot of, wind and like just various things from nature that are very mm-hmm. unsettling. It's like filtering nature through a computer in some way that I see.
It's Nine Inch Nails was always labeled, especially with like after Pretty Hate Machine, which is a pretty like synth poppy album. Mm-hmm. But you know, they fell into the industrial music mm-hmm. and I don't think it's a stretch to call David Lynch, especially like Eraserhead and stuff, an industrial filmmaker. I mean, mm-hmm. that those landscapes of Philadelphia, I mean, that like that's where the sound comes from. Yeah. Like, you know, like the opening credits of Twin Peaks with the lumber mill, you know, and like this gritty, unkempt sort of look. I mean, that falls right into Nine Inch Nails, even like their visual aesthetic, which, mm-hmm. Like for the albums, for the videos he did for like the, I don't know if have you ever watched like the Happiness and Slavery videos and stuff from, yeah. I mean, you would not like it, I would say. it was a thing that like you couldn't watch. You had to get like a bootleg of it. And I think they did officially release it, but it was like, you know, it was like torture porn. Like it was like literally a guy who was a performance artist, like getting tortured by machines and it was, you know, that was even in the video for Down In It was like, looked like a snuff film. Like there was always this gritty evil to his stuff.
Yeah. There's definitely, I mean, evil's a good word, I think, to some degree, because I feel like it's all encompassing. It's darkness. It's this idea of you know, what we fear, I guess, you know what I mean? And I don't mean it in sort of the Blumhouse kind of way. And I don't hate the Blumhouse movies, but like, I don't necessarily feel like David Lynch or Trent Reznor are making horror. You know what I mean? Like they're not looking to frighten you necessarily. I think they're trying to kind of show you the darkness that really exists in the world and to mm-hmm. like come face to face with it and fucking deal with it. As opposed to people that are like, something jumping out at you and trying to scare you. Like, I think those are two very different things.
Yeah. I mean, like the guy behind, or the person behind the Winkies in Mulholland Drive definitely is a bit of a jump scare, and it's horrifying.
It is,
and there are some jump scares in Lost Highway in a way, but
sure.
The real, like, sure. the menace and the evil in, like, Twin Peaks, you know, with Bob. I mean, really, it just comes down to the whole story in that is just something that happens in real life, and it's horrible and unfortunate. And I think the banality of evil, like, mm-hmm. just how commonplace some of these things are, is, mm-hmm. I don't think, yeah, they're not looking for these, like, supernatural, like,
well,
this is the evil that exists in general, like, all over the place.
You just said the word that I was thinking. I don't, when I think of Nine Inch Nails, there's nothing supernatural about them.
No.
And I would even argue that David Lynch isn't a supernatural filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I think that he's existing in a dream space, in a nightmare space, but I don't think that it's anything that he feels doesn't quote unquote exist in this world, which is terrifying. But but I think that it's a really interesting marriage, and it's also, you know, the David Bowie Nine Inch Nails marriage is also an interesting one, because I think that David Bowie also exists in this fantasy type experience, you know, again, not supernatural per se, but just sort of alternate universe-y, if that makes any sense. Like, I think that them getting into bed together, you know, I'm sure you remember this. I certainly do, because it was kind of when David Bowie reemerged a little bit. You know what I mean? In the 80s, he was sort of in this, you know, he had some big hits, but then he kind of just disappeared a little bit. And as the chameleon that he is, comes resurfaces as this sort of industrial basin drums artist with Trent Reznor. What did you think of that period in his career and how they sort of spoke to each other?
I mean, well, I was never the biggest Bowie fan. Like, I knew his stuff from the 70s.
Sure.
I knew Ashes to Ashes. I you know, like, you knew all, everyone knows the singles and stuff like that.
Let's
but I
Dance.
Never really, yeah, Let's Dance. I never listened to those albums.
Sure.
It was, I think it was as surprising to me as to anyone, though, when, like, I'm Afraid of Americans and stuff like that. Like, that was, mm-hmm. it was a huge song. I mean, mm-hmm. not huge in the way that, like, you know, like a pop star gets huge, but it was, it was on, you know, the video was on all the time, and it was
his biggest hit in probably, you know, probably seven or 10 years, maybe something like that.
And yeah, I mean, it catapulted him back into relevance, but not in, like, in the kind of the same way that, like, the Pearl Jam, Neil Young thing, like, Sonic Youth and Pearl Jam, and how these, like, these grunge artists, quote unquote, like, not that Sonic Youth was grunge, but, you know, they were part of, they were precursors to that scene, brought him back into the spotlight and gave him a resurgence. Like, Bowie kind of follows on the industrial edge. And really, when it comes to, like, mainstream industrial music, it was really just Nine Inch Nails. Like, no one else got the same level of exposure. Like, Ministry was, like, kind of big.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, KMFDM, you would see their videos on Much Music sometimes, but, like, it was really Nine Inch Nails.
That, well, and then you had Trent producing, and you had Trent producing stuff at a certain point too, right? So he starts producing,
and then
Marilyn Manson and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But then it falls. I mean, and this kind of is, you know, thinking what music was like in '99. I think after, in the same way that after Nirvana hit it big, and, like, all these labels tried to find the next Nirvana, and they signed some legitimately great artists. But then they also catapulted these, like, horrible artists into the mainstream. Well, I think, and I don't know if this is because of Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails, but, like, 99 is horrible for mainstream rock and roll, in that, to me, and I think this is...
You're not probably a fan of Freak on a Leash, Scott? I thought that was, like, your favorite song.
I mean, you've got Korn, you've got Limp Bizkit, you've got Kid Rock with Ba Wit Da Ba. Like, this is 99 stuff. And
It is.
I think my initial reaction to some of the Fragile was, holy shit, some of this sounds like new metal. Like, and it, part of it's the production, and that his voice is like a little more masculine, a little more forward.
Yep.
And I think that threw me off of a few songs on the Fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I mean, I don't care about Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys. Like, those artists will have always existed and will always exist. There's always going to be like a pop star, you know, and there's always going to be that stuff. But like Korn and Limp Bizkit and like, oh, like Slipknot. Like, I don't think I've ever heard a Slipknot song, and I hate them simply because, like, I would see, I remember, and let's tie this to Ryerson. I remember going to buy tickets, concert tickets, in person from the Sunrise on Yonge Street. You know, the one by, like,
I do. Yeah.
Or I was walking by that.
Where A&A Sunrise used to be, right? World.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
which one of them sold? One of them sold concert tickets where you actually had to like line up.
It was Sunrise. It was Sunrise.
Yeah, Sunrise. And I remember walking by Sunrise, and it was probably in '99. And this will tie into your movie podcast as well. I used to wear because I'm a recovering goth. Like, I used to wear a black trench coat because I was super into The Crow when I was in like grade 9, and it carried. Anyways, so. At that time, I had short, dyed black hair that was a little spiky. And I remember walking by that Sunrise wearing this trench coat and probably like black 501s and my Docs and whatever. And there was a lineup of kids in full-on Slipknot regalia because they used to like dress up like monsters. And one of them yelled out to me, "Oh, look, it's Neo from The Matrix." And I was like, "Oh, are you fucking kidding? Like, this is what I get now? Now I'm Neo from The Matrix?" Because that's what's popular this year. In high school, they used to call me Marilyn Manson.
Says a guy dressed up in fucking Slipknot, let's not throw stones.
Yeah, it was.
But I'll tell you this. It's funny. You bring up the new metal thing, which I think is a completely fair misinterpretation of Nine Inch Nails. Okay. I also think it's a misinterpretation of Rage Against the Machine.
Do they get lumped in with that? I mean, I guess they...
Sure, right? I mean, like, it should also be said, you know, Rage Against the Machine's last album, Battle for Los Angeles, comes out in 99 as well. Okay. We did an episode on that. I think that the sort of rap rock, as much as that's not a fair, you know, label for Rage Against the Machine, does get kind of co-opted a little bit by some... Like, Limp Bizkit is, unfortunately... an offshoot of a Rage Against the Machine. It's unfortunate. I mean, it's interesting though to see how Nine Inch Nails has evolved to a certain degree. I mean, I want to just give a very brief kind of cursory history of the band. They form in 98 in, of all cities, Cleveland, Ohio. It's not where I expected. 88. Trent Reznor is obviously singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, producer, the only permanent member of the band until the official addition of Atticus Ross in 2016, for what that's worth. Their debut album, Pretty Hate Machine, is released in 89. They feud with the label, and then how they promoted the album, which is a sort of forebearer of what's to come in terms of the control that Trent wants to have over how these albums are promoted, marketed, released. Signs with Interscope, releases an EP, Broken, in 92. Downward Spiral comes out in 94, which is obviously a staggering success, still their most successful album. Catapults them to a surprising level of fame, because Trent, for all intents and purposes, said that he made an album that he thought had no singles and thought was not going to be successful at all. It's enormously successful. 5 years go by, Fragile is released to critical acclaim, not commercial success. Nine Inch Nails has sold over 20 million records. They've been nominated for 13 Grammy Awards, including winning two for the songs Wish in 92 and Happiness and Slavery in 96. Time Magazine named Trent Reznor one of the most influential people in 1997, while Spin Magazine once described him as the most vital artist in music. In 2004, Rolling Stone placed Nine Inch Nails as 94 on its list of the 100 greatest artists of all time. Nine Inch Nails were nominated for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014, their first year of eligibility, and were nominated again in 2015 and 2020, where they actually did get in recently. It seems only appropriate that they would get in during a pandemic. In 97, Reznor produces the soundtrack to Lynch's Lost Highways, we mentioned, which featured one new Nine Inch Nails song, The Perfect Drug. Around this time, Reznor's studio Perfectionism, struggles with addiction, and bouts of writer's block prolonged the production of The Fragile. Over a year before the album's release, Reznor suggested, presumably deliberately misleadingly, that the album would be, quote unquote, irritating to people. It's not traditional Nine Inch Nails. Think of the most ridiculous music you could ever imagine with nursery rhymes over top of it, a bunch of pop songs. I'm sure that was just him fucking with people, but I mean,
I don't know if there are definite pop songs on this album that are, I mean, you can hear the writer's block, and you can hear I'm not going to say overproduction, because I mean, it's Nine Inch Nails. They kind of are built on layers and layers of production, but it does feel a bit like he didn't have a specific path to follow on it. It's not a consistent thought. It definitely sounds like it was made over a period of time, and not like one of those, you know, 2 days in the studio and you bang out an album. This feels like a labor of, I don't even say it's a labor of love, but it's like a labor.
It's a labor.
It's laborious for sure. But I can hear like lyrically, it is very simple. At times, I would say juvenile in a way.
For sure. Very confessional at times. Very sort of like writing in my diary sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I know that lyrics are important to Trent Reznor and definitely to a lot of his fans. They was, as much as I liked some of, like, it was never the lyrics that really drove it home for me when it comes to Nine Inch Nails. It was the combination of things. I mean, really the sound and the imagery and the fact that he does write catchy songs.
It's funny, you brought up the Song Exploder episode, which I highly recommend everybody watch on Netflix if they get a chance. He did something or said something during the episode, which I thought was really interesting. And it made me, I thought of it as I was listening to The Fragile. He talks about hiding his voice. He talks about that the song Hurt, which the episode of Song Exploder is examining, was, a very personal song to him. And it felt like he was exposing himself and he was insecure about that. So he buries his vocals under layers and layers and layers of other things and sort of deconstructs them and fucks with his voice. You sense that a lot on The Fragile too. There's a lot of stuff that he's just sort of like burying under sort of loads of production, which I think is interesting. So two other things I want to mention. In September 10th, 1998, at the 1998 MTV Video Music Awards, a 30-second teaser trailer was shown on television to promote the then-untitled album. It would be more than a year before the album was finally released. That in itself is sort of insane. But I want to read something out of Stereo Gum that I think is really interesting about their 1999 VMA performance. 1999 was the first VMA since MTV had introduced the after-school show Total Request Live. And so that year's show marked a sort of coronation of the new breed of flashy, upbeat, larger-than-life pop stars. Kid Rock opened the 99 VMAs with Run DMC and Aerosmith. Eminem closed the show with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. Britney Spears and NSYNC performed on stage together. They made it look like a high school classroom. And the Backstreet Boys had made their VMA debut in 1998. But in 99, they were conquering heroes. And somewhere in there, Nine Inch Nails debuted their title track of the new double album that they had released a few weeks later. The performance that Nine Inch Nails gave that night is, by award show standards, pretty great. The Fragile opens with a heavy-hearted churn and ends with a fire-drone rock-out conclusion. The whole time, Trent Reznor projects a steely intensity, but there's a moment about halfway through where Reznor breaks. Bathed in blue light and surrounded by metal latticework, Reznor has his arms up in a Jesus Christ pose, but he stops midline, laughing into his own armpit. Maybe he's just high as shit, or maybe he's helpless at the absurdity of the entire situation. Either way, it's pretty obvious to anyone watching that Trent Reznor, one of the decade's dominant rock stars, had become an instant relic. I think there's something interesting there. I didn't see that VMAs. I've seen clips of it. The ridiculous spectrum of artists performing on that stage. But then for Trent, this comes back to what we were saying earlier. 5 years is a long time. So he's reemerged in a completely different musical landscape. It's just like, wait a fucking second. Yeah. I can't do this like this. This is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I remember like like the MTV like awards in the mid 90s mm-hmm. were like something yeah. that you would want to watch. You know, like they're not anymore for me anyways, but like sure. you can really see the shift between like if he was performing at the 94 VMAs, like he'd be surrounded by more artists that were in, and which is, I mean, Dre did work on The Fragile. So
there's along there's, with everyone else and their mother, it seemed yeah. like.
But I mean, it's such a different, it's such a change. And I'm sure there were big pop stars in 94 as well. Like I'm like Mariah Carey, I'm guessing had sure, something sure. huge at the time. And like, there was still
yeah,
that.
Madonna, of, I mean, like it's, there were yeah. still lots of big artists. Yeah.
But I think people were still reeling from the reemergence of rock and roll to the forefront, which mm-hmm. hadn't really been there, mm-hmm. you know, in a while, because at that point, I mean, even lumping in like bands like Guns N' Roses and stuff like that, like the last time rock was like, what was its last mainstream sort of thing? Like hair metal in the '80s. Probably. And like, that wasn't yeah. a mainstream sort of
and
thing.
And then you, so, I mean, obviously grunge. And then the part of it, I think too, is, and I think you'll sort of understand where I'm coming at, this commodification of angst. Right. Mm-hmm. This idea of when they saw the success of grunge, they were like, oh, wait a second. There's a lot of like unhappy teens out there, quote unquote. Let's make money off of them. Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, you have grunge, then you obviously you have Kurt Cobain dying in 94. Then this weird sort of like three-legged dog of grunge for a few years until that kind of dies away. And mixed into this, into that kind of weird thing is Nine Inch Nails, right? I mean, they're yeah. they're coming up in the sort of mid to late 90s.
Yeah, like separate but equal in terms of popularity.
Correct.
And I mean, that's also, you got like Lollapalooza happening then. So you've yeah. got this like yeah. massive, you know, rock centric festivals, yep. which, you know, you look at some of those early lineups and it's insane.
It's crazy.
Who's playing together. So you have, you know, more in the mainstream, this like a pretty good quality rock and roll scene, even though it's super popular. I mean, there's always been great like rock and roll, indie, you know, stuff, punk, all of the new wave stuff. There's tons of great like music in the 80s that wasn't mainstream, but you know, it's mm-hmm. still, and even now, even in 99, there was like, looking at the list of albums that came out in 99, like it's not a great year for popular music, I would say. But there's still some of my favorite albums came out in 99, which I yeah. don't really think of it that way because I wasn't listening to those artists at the time. I started listening yeah, to them like 10 years later sort of thing.
Similarly, I mean, this comes back to sort of, and we've had these discussions, you and I and in groups of friends, in terms of, you know, is something good because it's popular and vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea of success and popularity and you know, I'm sure we all have friends that like bands until they become popular. And then they're just like, well, I knew them before they were popular. And then then they don't want to listen to them anymore. But I think that this album is interesting because it feels like Reznor said here, I have this quote where he said, described by Reznor as a sequel to The Downward Spiral, an album with a plot detailing the destruction of a man. The Fragile is a concept album dealing with his personal issues, including depression, angst, drug abuse. Reznor said, I wanted this album to sound like there was something inherently flawed in the situation, like someone struggling to put the pieces together. The Downward Spiral was about peeling off layers and arriving at a naked, ugly end. This album starts at that end, then attempts to create order from chaos, but never reaches the goal. It's probably a bleaker album because it arrives back where it starts with the same emotion. The album begins with somewhat damaged and ends with ripe with decay. Then in 2019, Reznor said, The Fragile occupies a very interesting and intimate place in my heart. I was going through a turbulent time in my life when making it, and revisiting it has become a form of therapy for me, which I think is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. So The Fragile was conceived by making songwriting and arranging and production and sound design the same thing. A song would start with a drum loop or a visual, and eventually a song would emerge out of it. And that was the song. I mean, how do you feel about, you're a person obviously who's doing this literally with your own music to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. You know, he relied a lot on soundscapes, electronic beats, ambient noise, rock laden guitar usage of melodies as harmonies, what have you, industrial noises and what have you. Are you, do you see yourself, or do you do you find yourself doing similar things, finding the music in things that might not necessarily be overtly musical?
I mean, that's not me.
That's not your bag.
I can definitely hear that, you know, like yeah. I, you know, you can hear stuff even just, not that anyone walks around anymore, but you know, you hear stuff when you're out in an environment that,
yeah.
that certainly resonates as being musical, even if it's not a specific like tone or rhythm or anything sure. like that. I mean, I think.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I don't know how much of that is, like, he put together, like, how many tracks is on this? Like, 22, 23 songs.
20
like
songs.
I'm sure in some cases that's that's how some songs came about, you know.
Yeah.
It was like maybe not even the instrumental ones, but parts of these songs that carry on for a long period of time. Like a lot of these songs move back and forth between like they're not super repetitive, some of them. Like there's really distinct parts where it's it'll go from a more pop-oriented sound to then into more of a soundscapey ambient sound and then back into it. So it seems like there was a lot of meddling with like different concepts and gluing things together. There's a lot of construction for sure on this album.
It feels like you're listening to it being like, there's a method to this madness here. Like it's messy. But it feels intentional. It all sort of has this sort of very kind of stream of consciousness kind of vibe to it as well. It all kind of flows into itself. That's the other thing that mm-hmm. I kind of found interesting, you know, I wonder, you know, critics talked a lot about sort of progressive rock, art rock, electronica, avant-garde. It doesn't sound like anything else really. It sounds like Nine Inch Nails a little bit, or at least their previous output. But it's its own thing. And I can only imagine, you know, 99, the critics were pretty split on it. You know, Spin mm-hmm. said it was the best album of the year. Pitchfork Media said panned it and said it had melodramatic lyrics.
It does. You know,
both can be right. I think it's really interesting. It also has sort of the dubious achievement of at the time being the steepest drop in the history of music from number one to number 16.
I would totally understand why that would happen too.
Yeah, too.
Mean, if he says that there's no singles on the Downward Spiral.
Like, there are no singles on this really.
I mean, the ones that came out, like I remember seeing the video for, I think it was Into the Void mm-hmm. A few times, and definitely the video for Starfuckers a lot. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be the more popular of... Mm-hmm. Like of the singles, even though that wasn't like originally even supposed to be on the album, I don't think
it wasn't. The label jammed it on there at the last second because
it's a ridiculous song. Like even at the time, I was like, this song is not. There's a video of him and like Marilyn Manson in the back of the limo. I think. It's tons of vocal processing on that, like almost approaching like auto tuning in a way, mm-hmm. even though it's just it's more rhythmic than tonal.
That's the song that you look at and you're like. Okay, Korn, okay, Slipknot. Like you see all of that shit off of that.
Yeah, there's a few songs on the album that have that, which throws me off. And it's funny, we were talking about like him burying the vocals. I think he should have buried them a bit more on this because honestly, like this is the album where his voice changes. Like it becomes like more mature, a little older. it doesn't have the youthful sort of it's fuller, and it's also at the forefront more often than not of the mix. Mm-hmm. And it has a sort of, I mean, their music's always been aggressive, and it's always been masculine in many ways. Not to say that it's only popular with men, because it definitely is not. And that is also partially due to the fact that, you know, young Trent Reznor was very attractive.
Good looking. Yeah, good looking guy.
But this had a sort of masculinity to it, which never really resonated with me. It was a bit, it's like some of it's a bit too aggro sounding. And I think, again, this is in the context of like Korn and Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock and these, like, you know, like, I just, that
there's
music
a little
just.
Bit of, well, it feels a little, I don't want to say poser because that's not really what he's doing, but there is a chest out component at times on these songs where it's a guy who's trying to sort of be like putting on a bit of a show. Like, it doesn't feel like, it feels like what he thinks people want him to be.
Yeah, and it's odd because, I mean, he was working on this for so long, and it's weird that it comes out in the same year that, like, a lot of these, like, I would never assume that he was, like, aping on, like, this new metal stuff, because it would have been happening, you know, at the same time. Like, he would have been working on this while they were doing stuff, and it could just be coincidental that that was happening. And it's only on some of the tracks that it really jumps out to me. I'm trying to think, like, which ones. There's something about the, and I don't want to like shit on this album as being.
No,
like,
I don't think you are. I mean, I think it's a messy album, but I think a lot of people think it's a messy masterpiece.
It's funny. There's some songs. I think is it No You Don't, maybe, or where it's like, I absolutely hate half of the song, and then I really like the other half, and it's an impressive thing to have this like. Because it starts with like this nasally sort of whiny verse, but then the chorus and the way it climaxes at the end, where it gets super fuzzy and super distorted, and it reminds me a lot of like something off of Broken. It's like, this is fantastic, but then the other stuff has got this plodding sort of nasally sound to it, which it didn't sound like, and he's right, like it didn't sound like a Nine Inch Nails album, a lot of it. Sometimes that's a good thing. Like the use of more organic instrumentation is interesting. Like you can hear the space around the instruments, which might have something to do with Steve Albini working on it. He's like, I know you don't like music production's not really your thing, but Steve Albini is known for being like, he's produced, I mean, tons of bands that you love and that I love, you know, like, most famously, you know, he did In Utero, but also like the Pixies and the Breeders and then like Low and like tons of bands, like almost every band has worked with Steve Albini at some point. I didn't actually know that he worked on this album until like yesterday. Now knowing that, you can hear this sort of natural. So he tends to record stuff the way it sounds. So in a studio, he wants to be as transparent as possible in a way and let what the musicians are playing, like, let that be the sound.
Sure.
So you don't really go to him to like, make me sound like something like, you know, like make me sound like a certain band. You go to him if you want to sound like yourself. And you can hear on some of these tracks, like Somewhat Damaged, and you can hear like the fingers on the fretboard, you know, you can hear the strings sliding. You can hear the space around the instruments in a room, which you never really heard with Nine Inch Nails before. It was always super processed. You know, it's always Trent doing it by himself, really. So everything is much more composed in that way. Whereas this album has some space to it. Like my favorite track on this album, which I'll ask you, I guess, afterwards, what your favorite is, and I was wondering, going back to listen to it again, it had been a long time since I'd listened to it.
Sure.
How am I going to like listen? Like, how is it going to sound to me now?
Yeah.
And is my favorite track still going to be my favorite track? And it is. And it's an instrumental one. It's Just Like You Imagined. It's the seventh track. And it's, I mean, it sounds like it could have been, like, I think any of the instrumentals on this sound like they could have been in their more recent score work. Like, I hear some of these tracks, I'm like, that could easily have been on the Watchmen soundtrack. which
100%
to me was like the best Nine Inch Nails album since Downward Spiral, I would say.
Yeah,
because some of the tracks on the Watchmen soundtrack are like, gave me those early Nine Inch Nails feels, which was fantastic. And some of these tracks could easily have been on there. But so on that track, imagine you hear these, like, you can hear, it's all instrumentation. You can hear them playing as a band or whoever it was playing. And then it breaks down to some like this like loose freeform sort of piano in the middle of it. And then it ramps back up with more electronic elements. It's a really interesting track, and it still is to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think it should be said, you know, that when I listened to it, and I mentioned this earlier, it kind of all flowed into itself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, singling out specific songs is a little tricky. I will say, though, it does feel a little front-loaded to me in terms of, like, it really tries as much as it can under its own circumstances to hook you in the sort of the first handful of tracks, and then it hopes it holds on to you for the remainder of the ride. I mean, I'd be lying if I said that, you know, I really love We're In This Together. I know it's a single. And I think The Wretched is also a really beautiful song.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like musically, it's a very interesting track, I find.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Chuck Palahniuk, obviously the writer of Fight Club, said, "I remember being amazed when I first heard The Wretched. This wasn't just ennui. This was an active, aggressive, angry lack of caring. It's not let's kill ourselves. It's let's kill each other. It's not rock and roll. It's not classical. It's something in between," which I think is interesting. I also feel like, and I obviously want your opinion on this, because there's a bunch of music journalists that chimed in on various influences that they sensed in this album. Music journalist Ann Powers observed elements of progressive rock bands like King Crimson and Roxy Music, Reznor's influences, and the experimentation of electronic artists such as Architecture and Square Pusher, and wrote that The Fragile uses funk bass lines, North African minor key modulations, and the treatment of tonality by cymbalist composers like Debussy. And Rob Sheffield observes a prog rock vibe akin to Pink Floyd's 79 album, The Wall, and felt that The Fragile is similarly a double album that vents alienation and misery into paranoid studio hallucinations, each track crammed with overdubs until there's no breathing room. Do you sense all of this on there?
I mean, so that last comment about how there's no breathing room, I don't think that's really true. Okay. In a lot of cases, because they're actually, what I found interesting is that there is some breathing room on tracks.
Sure.
Like Somewhat Damaged. So the opening track starts with that, like, and this is where I think a lot of people got like the prog sort of sound, which, I mean, I don't really hear. I think as soon as you get syncopation in music, the easy thing is to just call it prog. But I would not call this a prog album by any stretch. Like, I'm not a big prog music fan. I'm not a big Pink Floyd fan. Like, I like some of their early stuff when they had Syd Barrett before he went insane on it. But there's one King Crimson album that I've listened to, which is the most listenable prog album, I would say, for me. It's got that 21st Century Schizoid Man, which is a great rock and roll track that, like, you could definitely hear that influenced, I'm sure, a lot of industrial artists and a lot of heavy artists, because you've got this crazy vocal processing that gives him that screamy sound. Mm-hmm. And you've got like a pretty big riff that you could definitely hear it on, what song is it on? Trying to think of the song on the Downspiral where you have like a guitar riff that's sort of mirrored with like a string sort of section that gives it like a bigger, more grandiose sound. You can hear that influence, but to call it like a prog album, I don't think is super accurate, because it's not as, prog music is super tight. Like, it's all about the art, like the musicians being totally in sync with each other when it comes to these like syncopated sounds. And I mean, yes, there is like a lot of, like, I'm sure in some of that music, there's a lot of layering and a lot of more dreamy type stuff, but I don't really hear that too much in here. Like Square Pusher, I'm sort of familiar with that kind of, I think what they're probably referring to there is like, there's a lot of like breakbeat type stuff on this, which you heard a lot on The Perfect Drug. Like The Perfect Drug has that crazy drum track underneath it, which is like manic and fast. And you hear that in parts on The Fragile for sure. But the album moves around so much, it's kind of hard to...
Well, that's kind of the thing, which I think is interesting. I mean, because of its sort of, I mean, schizophrenic kind of feeling to it, it clearly doesn't want to be pinned down. Like it clearly wants to be whack-a-mole in terms of, oh, you think it's this now, it's going to be this. Like it's just really trying to keep you on edge, which I think is part of its charm.
He's definitely following, like it's definitely an album that he's doing because this is what he wants to do.
Yeah.
Like if this was, if he wanted to make, I think if Trent Reznor wanted to make a full on pop album full of hits, he could do it. You know, like I'm sure he could write for other artists and make tons of money because he can write hooks. You know, he can write these things and they're on this album, but they're buried a bit more than.
Sure. But even if you compare this album to With Teeth, which is, you know, obviously many years later, post rehab, you know, gets his shit together, decides to put out a new album. I mean, that album is tight and short. It's got like singles. It's like, it is definitely an album with a mission, which is we're back and we're going to find some sense of the zeitgeist again. And I like With Teeth. I know that purists might not enjoy that album as much as others, and that's fine. But I enjoy some of the hits on that.
So I'll make a confession. I have not listened to a Nine Inch Nails album. Okay, I never listened to With Teeth. I've never listened to that album once. I know that there was it The Hand That Feeds? Was that on that album? I'm familiar with that song.
Yeah.
Between when The Fragile came out and when their next album came out, you know, like that's all of university.
How long was it between those? That's a good question.
It was another 5 years, I think. I think it was 2004.
5 years.
Yeah. And it was 5 years without the benefit of like a Lost Highway in the middle. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think at that point, I had like, you know, I've
2005. So it was
2005. Yeah. So we finished university.
Mm-hmm.
We've moved into like the next stage,
of our lives.
And it's funny. So I went to see, so I've seen Nine Inch Nails twice. I saw them on the Fragile tour, which, you know, we can talk about.
Definitely.
And then I saw them again, maybe 3 or 4 years ago when my oldest brother, who got me into Nine Inch Nails originally when I was like nine, he had an extra ticket and he's like, do you want to go to the show? And I was like, I probably wouldn't have paid to go see them at this point necessarily. But it was like,
they did a shit ton of tours. Like within the last, they toured pretty heavily until they retired again and then didn't retire and whatever. Anyway.
So I think this tour was before they did that release of like those three sort of EPs.
EPs, yeah.
Yeah. So this was maybe 2015, maybe early 2016. But anyways, I went to the show and it was incredible for a band that meant so much to me and that I listened to so much. I knew so few of the songs for a lot of the show, but people were into it. Like people were going crazy. And the one thing that really stood out to me is towards the end of the first set, I guess before the encore, they played, and I mentioned the song earlier, A Warm Place from Downward Spiral, which beautiful instrumental track.
Sure.
And like half the people in the section around me got up and left to go to like the bathroom or to go to get like a beer or something like that. And I was like, you're leaving during the one song from the biggest album. But they're singing along to all the words to these songs that I've never heard before. And I was like, it was so strange to be like that. There's this new section of Nine Inch Nails fans that don't listen to the stuff before With Teeth, I guess.
Yeah. It does feel like, you know, this hiatus that he takes, this 6 year hiatus to sort of get his life back together, however you want to denote it, does feel like a fulcrum point, right? Like it feels like a moment where he kind of turned a page. And listen, I With Teeth was a big fucking album. This was the reemergence of a enormously successful band from the 90s, rebranding itself. I mean, I remember seeing him perform at some show, if it was the Grammys or the VMAs or I don't know what, but I remember him performing The Hand That Feeds. I remember it being a great performance. It was the thing about With Teeth is it's the most accessible version of Nine Inch Nails.
Right.
So for a person like myself, it probably worked for me more than a person who loves this band through and through and has sort of like gone through the dark days of this band. To me, and I'm fully willing to admit that I'm a fair weather fan of this band. I enjoy a lot of their stuff. I listen to a lot of their stuff. The album that comes out after With Teeth, Year Zero, is actually one of my favorite albums of theirs.
Really?
Okay. Because of the story it tells. I mean, they tried to turn it into an HBO television show many years ago. And I think it's a fascinating album. I'm a fan of the concept album. I just enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah.
And I think that Trent Reznor is a good storyteller. I mean, I think he is a good, I mean, whether or not you want to look at his songs as stories or not, I mean, I think they are. They're emotional stories where he's sort of taking us on a journey. But to get back to your original point about seeing them now versus seeing them back in the day, I mean, they kind of are two versions, right? Like they're two different bands, really. And I mean, literally and figuratively. I mean, obviously we mentioned there's a lot of revolving door of people in the band, but also the band now feels like almost a hobby to Trent Reznor.
Well, kind of is,
you know,
it's
right?
Not like, big anymore, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that they probably became, so seeing them a few years ago and seeing them in, I guess it was probably 2000 or 2001. I think it was 2000. I mean, they became, you know, the earlier days, they were a minimal stage setup and they would just beat the shit out of each other and out of their instruments. Yes. Like the keyboard stands that whoever was playing synth at the time would have was like, I've never seen those anywhere else. It was on like a pivot. It was like, so that he could get the shit kicked out of him and the keyboard would stay in place and not just get knocked over.
It's crazy.
But then what they became, I think probably with the Fragile Tour, was a visual experience as well. So they became a much tighter, more polished machine with less room for shenanigans.
One of the most beautiful shows I've ever seen was
for sure. The one I saw a few years ago had an insane light component to it. This like
unreal
3D grid of lights that was like, it was amazing. And when they, you know, had the quieter moments where they were just playing and letting the stage show do the work, it was super impressive. The Fragile Tour, they and this will tie back to Ryerson. So I went to go see it with Will and with our friend Federico, who was an Italian exchange student, essentially. Not exchange, but you know,
still is Italian.
It's still very much like, if you think of what a Roman would look like, that's Federico.
Indeed.
Anyway, so the three of us went to that show. It was at Maple Leaf Gardens, which was the last. I saw two shows at Maple Leaf Gardens. I saw Smashing Pumpkins for the Melancholy Tour, and I saw.
I hate you for seeing that show. I could have gone and I didn't. I have no good excuse for it.
Again, so tying back to like Sunrise Records, I remember going to the mall near my house at like 6 a.m, getting in that lineup for tickets for Smashing Pumpkins, which is not a thing that happens anymore.
No.
Thankfully, because that was not fun. I've waited for a few shows like that in my life, and it's not the most fun thing in the world.
Now I look back on it wistfully, but I know what you're saying.
It was at Maple Leaf Gardens, and they had these, it was like a three-channel video projection. So you had these like three really, really tall, like,
was it, just out of curiosity, the show, was it in the round or did they block off one side of it for the stage? Do you remember? I'm just curious because like some bands...
No, they must have blocked it off. It must have been in half because it was definitely like a unidirectional show. You had to be looking at it from one angle.
That makes sense, yeah.
So you had these like, I don't know, 100-foot tall video screens, maybe bigger than that. These three super narrow tall screens playing this video, you know, not abstract stuff, but like filmed footage of like people diving into water and stuff like that. And it was gorgeous. It was like this beautiful setup. And in one section of the show, it was like an instrumental section. So they played like three or four instrumental songs in a row. I think all from The Fragile. May have been another one in there as well. So anyways, it was a gorgeous part of the show. It's my favorite part of the show, probably. all like in general, it was a fantastic show. Like,
it's
so afterwards.
Yes, yeah, please. Yeah.
So I found out like maybe a couple of years after that, when the DVD for that show came out and I bought it, mm-hmm. that the video artist that did the work was this guy, Bill Viola, who we had studied a lot at Ryerson in the new media program. He was like a preeminent video artist. Like he was mm-hmm. like a pretty big deal. And since then I've seen his work in galleries. Like, you know, like
really?
First time I went to Europe, we saw one of his video projections in this church in Bruges, I think it was. And it was like, you could tell like, this is the same artist, the same visual style and everything like that. It's a funny tie-in that, yeah.
Well,
it was
I feel like
show. I'll say that for sure.
I mean, this ties into, you know, to what you and Jan studied, quite honestly, mm-hmm. you know, which is this idea of there are certain artists and, you know, we a couple come to mind of trying to present you not just with a live music experience, right? It's like, it's the idea of your favorite artist or band getting on a stage and performing songs for you. That in and of itself is obviously a great thing. And obviously they know that, but to create an art installation within what they're doing and to try mm-hmm. to sort of elevate this experience to another level. I mean, Bjork comes to mind,
oh, for sure.
You know, and there are others obviously, but it transports you somewhere and it gets mm-hmm. you thinking about things. You know, we studied this together in you know, first year we had a lot of classes together to talk about sort of the overlap and the unity of these different art forms. And when you see that symbiosis of visual and music and lyrics and all of it coming together, it's a transcendent experience. And, you know, I think that it's something that Trent obviously went out of his way to do. I mean, at the time, Interscope refused to fund the tour for The Fragile. So Reznor committed to fund the entire tour himself, which wow. quickly sold out. So he concluded, he said, the reality is I'm broke at the end of the tour, but also I'll never present a show that isn't fantastic. Like, I think that there's something about this, and the history of music and film and television is littered with people that have decided to put themselves on the line and to mortgage their house or do whatever it is in order to make that art thing, that piece of art. And it's tremendous. That being said, during this tour, Trent Reznor suffers a heroin overdose in London in June of 2000, forcing that show to be canceled and pushing Reznor into rehab and putting Nine Inch Nails on hold until he became sober. Yeah. You know, what's interesting too, and this ties into the Song Exploder episode that we watched, is that Hurt is covered by Johnny Cash in 2002 and becomes sort of this tome or however you want to call it to sort of his career and, mm-hmm. and sort of looks and it's a beautiful cover. It's a tremendous music video directed by Mark Romanek.
It's one of the best music videos, I think.
Right, because like, it's a life in 4 minutes.
it's incredible. Yeah.
It's shocking. It really is. And after seeing the music video, which later won a Grammy, Trent Reznor himself obviously became a fan of it. And there's this great quote here where he said, "I popped the video in, and wow, tears welling, silence, goosebumps. I felt like I lost my girlfriend because that song isn't mine anymore. It really made me think about how powerful music is as a medium and art form. I wrote some words and music in my bedroom as a way of staying sane about a bleak and desperate place I was in, totally isolated and alone. Somehow that winds up being reinterpreted by a music legend from a radically different era and genre and still retains sincerity and meaning. Different, but every bit as pure." I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, I think it's really interesting how attached and distant Trent is from his own work. Like, he has this analytical perspective, mm-hmm. and this is probably post drugs, but he has this perspective now mm-hmm. of being able to sort of intellectualize the process of what he's doing and yet also be emotionally invested in it, which I think is really fascinating.
So, I mean, I'll say this as I would never describe myself as a songwriter, but I mean, I've written songs, so I guess I kind of am. I've always listened to what other songwriters I admire say about the songwriting process.
Yeah.
And there's a few different things that always there's a common thread that I think a lot of songwriters have, is that you're not necessarily writing the song yourself. You're kind of discovering it. One artist I like, it's like akin to like pulling this fully formed thought out of the air, you know, like, and then it's just yours. Towns Van Zandt said, you know, like, asked about like, you know, why do I talk about my songs in this sort of way that maybe sounds like self-indulgent, like saying they're great songs. And he's kind of said something like, if I didn't write it, someone else would. Like, it's not really my song. It's a song that existed and I'm the one that found it first. There's another like line from this live Neil Young performance that I love, where he says, he's about to play a song and he says, here's a song I just learned. I wrote it too. And it's like, it's that feeling like, it's not really your song. It's like, you just, it was out there and you figured out how to vocalize it, like how to make. And so I can understand why. I mean, I'm sure that was a tremendously personal song for Trent, but at the same time, it's like, once it's out there, it's, I don't know, like,
it's not yours anymore. First and foremost.
And some people just don't even think it was ever theirs to begin with. You know, like I've written songs, sometimes it's a surprise, you know, like all of a sudden, like I can write a song and like, it'll be fully formed in a matter of minutes, and it's shocking. But I mean, some people are obviously much more prolific at that than others. I think for Trent, knowing that he was more of a classically trained musician, he can definitely sit and compose in ways that, like, I certainly wouldn't. And a lot of artists just can't. Like, he said in that song, a Splitter Thing, that the piano is his, you know, sort of weapon of choice. When it comes to songwriting, that's where he starts. And I'm sure a lot of this album started on piano and then expanded outwards, because there's only so much you can do with that instrument.
I totally agree with you about this idea of tapping into something. I mean, I've often had moments where I write a scene and it's like fucking pulling teeth, right? It's just, it takes hours, days, you know, and sometimes it just never works and you're just like, fuck it, I got to move on. And then there are times where, I think this is sort of what you're talking about, where it just feels like a wavelength. It feels like a thing that you've tapped into out in the universe. And I'm not a hippy dippy person by any means, but there is something, I don't know if it's larger than us necessarily, but that just sort of uses you as a vessel for a second, or you use it, and you're sort of tapping into something. And I agree with you. It doesn't totally feel yours. It feels like there's something else, you know, I don't want to say using you, but I think you know what I mean. It's really interesting. I think that it's also, you know, there's this quote here. It's the last quote that I have from this Stereo Gum article that I really like, because it says, the Fragile is an immersion album, 104-minute internal head trip where the sound design resonates more than the riffs or hooks or lyrics. To listen to the Fragile on headphones is to disappear into its world. You can listen to a song at a time, but it's a whole lot more satisfying to give yourself over to it, to let each pling and whir and hum and dissolving scrape sound sweep you away. But in 1999, huge mass audiences were, by and large, not willing to sacrifice their consciousness to Trent Reznor's cinematic imagination. And I think that I mean, first of all, it really sums up how I feel about this album. I think that it is an art piece, that it is some sort of an installation piece that is demanding all of you. And if you can't give all of yourself to it, it will not be as rewarding an experience, I imagine. Mm-hmm. It's why he's talked about in the past how now he has people coming up to him saying that it's their favorite Nine Inch Nails album. I think those people have let themselves go to it. Like, they've given themselves over to it and allowed it to be really important to them. It's an experience. They've gone on a journey with this thing and they've allowed it sort of inside them. There's so little music that can be described that way. You know what I mean? Albums that can be described this way, which makes it so special, and also makes it, you know, you said it yourself, it's not your favorite Nine Inch Nails album. It's not mine either. That's not to say that it's not an unbelievable achievement and that it's not an amazing album in its own right. it also feels in its own fucked up way like the quintessential 1999 album, right? Like in the sense that it was misinterpreted, made by a person who is, you know, dealing with significant problems, launched 1,000 shitty ships of new metal and what have you. Yeah. And also, quite frankly, took him to his breaking point in order to find a way forward for himself in a career that's been unbelievably successful since in different ways.
Yeah,
it's just it was unbelievably successful and then dropped off, like this idea of just this hugely, you know, big chart topping album that drops off the charts. I just think it's fascinating.
So what year is The Social Network? Is that 2010?
It's 2010. Yeah.
So, I mean, if you break his career up into like 10-year increments, let's say he started working on Social Network in 2009,
sure.
The soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's like you get Pretty Hate Machine in 89, you get The Fragile in 99, and then you launch your career as a, you know, as scoring movies with The Social Network. Like it's an interesting trajectory.
Okay.
Like to go from this bedroom synth pop artist, essentially, mm-hmm. to that weird space between Downward Spiral and With Teeth, to then to what he is now, which is, I mean, ultimately more successful than
music composer.
Yeah, like it's crazy. I mean, and it's not really that surprising because, like, the music on his albums was always to me like the strongest part. And he said it himself in that Song Exploder thing. He's not the best singer in the world. No. Like he says, like, oh, I wish I had that instrument like Bowie has to be able to sing like that. You know, but musically, he's always been a brilliant composer. Like if you stripped all of the singing away from his albums, they'd still be, and I know they did that with The Fragile. I've never listened to that instrumental version.
But I haven't either, yeah.
There's, you know, when you can write a catchy instrumental track, you know that you're a good composer. Because a lot of times it's just, for a lot of artists, it's just the background. You know, the vocals are all that matter. And pop music especially, you know, like you get one hook and you loop that for half the song. And then the vocals are at the forefront. Whereas, you know, you take a look at like, so Closer is, you know, arguably his biggest song. I mean, it was certainly at the time became very well known for a bunch of reasons. It was extremely controversial song, but you strip the vocals away from that song and it's still like a killer song to listen to.
Yeah,
like he's always had that funk element that the critic wrote about for this. Mm-hmm. He's always had that slithery sort of bass line. It's always been very danceable because, I mean, that's important to this genre of music. Like,
yeah, you know, you something that I think should be said about music composing and why Trent Reznor is so good at it. I remember way back when I watched the pilot for Sleepy Hollow without score. I was just, you know, just the assembly. And I was like, oh yeah, I mean, this works, this is fine. And then the composer did the score and all of a sudden you're like, I understand how to feel now. Like music composition, scoring of movies, and I think that any director worth their salt will admit this, that the music is what fucking makes it work. Like it is what propels everything forward. It's what gives you emotion. It's what gives you propulsion. It is everything. And for Trent in, you know, specifically Social Network, but in so many of his other, him and Atticus's other scores, it's just to find that beautiful marriage of what could be described as dissident drone noise, the beauty of that, the propulsion of that. And then also just this, he taps into emotion so beautifully. Like to your point, take the lyrics away, take the singing away. He knows how to tap into just raw emotion. And that's why I think he's such a beautiful music composer.
Think about the piano drops at the end of Closer.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. That, which is almost to me like the theme song for Nine Inch Nails, the band. Like that, that melody has repeated itself in various ways. But like, I mean, I can see the video of him like leaning over the piano playing those notes. But like, yeah, and getting emotion out of that simplicity of music, because his stuff can be super simple. Like, it's going to be really layered, but the melodies are, they're not like Sufjan Stevens, like his instrumental works, which are like bombastic and insane.
Theatrical, like, at least. Yeah.
And I mean, I love them, but like, you know, Trent is makes things a little more, it's a little more streamlined when it comes to
minimalist
quality, like
quality for yeah. sure. Yeah.
But yeah, so thinking of scoring, like, it's amazing. I agree that like the music does so much work. It's amazing that like No Country for Old Men has no music until he wakes up in Mexico or wherever it is.
Yep.
With that, with
yep.
that. And that movie is close, but I was thinking about like Neil Young's score for Dead Man, which is mm-hmm. like, again, simple and propulsive, and it's, you know, it's in that same vein, I think, of, I mean, I could see Trent being a fan of that kind of thing, because it's very atmospheric. It's not just, you know, straightforward guitar work. It's a lot of rumbling. There's a lot of simplicity in both their works.
You could also, I mean, you can see it in Johnny Greenwood's work on There Will Be Blood versus yeah. Phantom Thread, you know, which are obviously two drastically different scores. Yeah. But I think that you're sort of speaking to that sort of minimalist quality that Trent brings to it. Also, it just makes you feel very stripped. It makes you feel very primal in a way mm-hmm. that I think a lot of composers don't go there. I mean, he's also coming at it. I mean, he's pretty open about it. I watched a really great video interview with him talking with Alan Sepinwall, him and Atticus talking about the score to Watchmen. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's very open about the fact that he's just like, we don't really know what we're doing. Like, we're not, like, it's not as though this was a conscious effort. I mean, yeah. Fincher, who knows how he even convinced them to do the score for Social Network, but that sort of, obviously that opens the door. But like, again, this is sort of, it's a little bit of baby steps, right? It's, you know, we see obviously there's instrumental stuff in Nine Inch Nails, and then you have like the Ghosts album albums, which are just strictly instrumental. So it's not like a huge leap for Fincher to ring him up and say like, no. Why don't you compose this? But, you know, they're so good at it probably because there's this element of winging it, a little bit of just not knowing the quote unquote rules of composing a score.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, I mean, and sometimes like I didn't really love Tom York's score to Suspiria personally.
Right.
It doesn't always work out. Yeah. I mean, we've seen many artists try to do the music to movies.
Oh, yeah. Most of the times it's forgettable. I think it's amazing how successful they were on their first shot at this. Yeah. Like it's not surprising, but I mean, like it could have been horrible. Like, well, it could have been overindulgent. It could have been messy and too big for that. But it was so, yeah. I mean, I've only seen The Social Network. I think I've seen it twice. It's from what I remember of the score, it's fairly minimal. Like it was.
Yeah. It's a lot of piano and a fair amount of electronic drone.
So I think it worked perfectly for that. Yeah. I mean,
there's a reason why we're not talking about Billy Corgan's score to Stigmata, for instance.
Probably a few reasons, yeah. I would definitely not, if I was making a picture, Corgan wouldn't be my first call. That's,
yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing. And if I do find it very interesting how, and on a previous podcast, I think I was talking about how Hollywood is not particularly accepting to musicians deciding they want to be actors. But the music industry seems very accepting of actors that decide they want to make an album or something like that.
It's pretty, the thing is, when you're an actor, you can make an album and it's not that expensive. You know, like if I can make an album, someone with tens of millions of dollars can easily get the studio time and I don't know how successful that's ever been. I know that Simon is a big fan of Robert Mitchum's Calypso album.
Surprises me not at all.
Yeah. But it's not, yeah, it's so rare for it to work either way.
Yes,
there's been some great performances by musicians.
For sure.
There's definitely been more great performances by musicians as actors than actors as musicians, I would say.
I think that's a very safe assessment. Yeah. I think that yeah. But it also goes to show how, on another level, how accepting, I don't know if accepting is the right word, but how many music artists come over and decide that they do want to try to compose. It seems to be more of a thing now. I think that Trent obviously has warmed the waters for that a little bit. And I also think that if you're Tom York or Johnny Greenwood or whoever, and you start to say to yourself, I mean, how long am I going to be in Radiohead? How long do I want to be doing this for? It's another musical outlet that allows you to sort of scratch that itch and, quite frankly, continue to be relevant while not having to tour.
Yeah, not having to tour is probably a big thing as you get into your 50s. I'm sure that becomes, yeah. I mean, for some artists, it doesn't matter. Like some guys just never stop touring. Like Dylan never stops touring and Neil Young never stops touring. And like Willie Nelson's always playing shows, I'm sure. And like a lot of these guys who are like,
but these guys feel like they might die if they don't.
They probably will. they need a hobby, right? I know that
Clint Eastwood has said that. He's like, I keep making movies because I'm afraid that if I stop, I'm going to keel over. And there might be some legitimacy to that.
Yeah.
A lot of artists have said, you know, and a lot of people just in general, which is that as you get older, it's keeping this going. It's keeping yourself inspired. It's keeping your brain going. And the second that you just sort of start vegging out on a couch watching television, you know, it's not great. It's not great for the brain. But but this was, I mean, honestly, this album, I'm so thankful that you were willing to come on and talk about it. And
my pleasure.
I really think that it's these episodes that I've done a couple of them now. I did a Smashing Pumpkins episode. I did as I mentioned, a Moby episode. Doing this episode, I mean, obviously all very different bands, all very different artists, has really sort of given me a new appreciation for, you know, what goes into them. I think that, and I know you feel this way too, that it's for the best that people out in the world don't know how hard it is to make these things, because it's ultimately, it'll hurt the experience of enjoying it, right? Like they should enjoy the purity of going to see a movie or watching a television show or listening to an album. But if you do the research and you do the due diligence to kind of dig into them, you realize what a labor of love, or maybe not even love, just the laborious quality and how special they are. You're making music, you understand how difficult it is to do these things. So when you listen to an album like this, you must find yourself going like, Jesus Christ, like I can't even imagine the undertaking of something like this.
For sure. I mean, with this album, with Downward Spiral as well, like it's hard to understand where he comes up with the inspiration to put some of this stuff together. I mean, it is, there's so much work that goes into those albums, like so much work. And it's one thing to like multi-track a bunch of guitars on top of each other with drums and sing, but there's levels upon levels. Like there's all these layers that build this up, but these are also these are difficult songs. They're not verse, chorus, verse songs. They're not just, there's not a lot of repetition on them. There's a lot of movement and like some great playing on these records too. I think like musically, it's a super interesting album that, you're right, does not sound like anything other than parts of other Nine Inch Nails albums at some times. Mm-hmm. And then just like a whole different sound that no one else really picked up on, and they didn't really carry through, I don't think, until some of the scores that he started working on. That's the only time you start to hear some of this stuff again.
The last thing I wanted to talk about real quick is the idea of, you know, if a band or an artist can stick around long enough and stay relevant long enough, they're going to hit some sort of a moment where they say, no, fuck you. Like I've decided I'm going to deconstruct the thing that you love. Yeah. If it's Radiohead doing Kid A, if it's whoever, like there's always the like quote unquote difficult album, the album where they just push back on all the preconceived notions of their
of their fame, of their success, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like you have those fans that love an artist or a band, and that they hone in on the hard album. Like they hone in on the one that's like that's challenging, that's keeping mm-hmm. them at arm's length. And I think that this is that album for Nine Inch Nails for sure, and perhaps the one atop the mountain of difficult, challenging albums from a successful band or artist. And I really do respect fans that want to work for it. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? That yeah. want to love the thing that artist is saying, okay, but this is going to be hard to love, and this is going to be a challenge. And I love fans that are up to that. Do you sort of know what I'm getting at?
I've had some albums where it's taken me a lot of listens to love an album. And maybe you hear something that's carrying you through that process. Because there's some albums you just listen to and like, no, forget it. I don't want to. Mm-hmm. You can figure out after a minute that you don't want to listen to it. But there's some that you have to live with for a bit. And you have to let it get like ingrained into you till you hear like, okay, why did this artist make these choices? Why does this exist the way it does? And that's the same with film as well. Or any sort of visual art, as well. Like I think this album is sort of like that. I've listened to it a lot and I still think it's more, I don't know if it's a perfect statement. Like, I don't think it has that element where eventually I would just learn to love the whole thing and accept it. Because I don't think it's there. I think there's too many parts of this album that he may not want to admit to it, but we're definitely commercially minded. There are some sure. songs on this album that sound like they were recorded for the radio, which yep. is unlike anything up to this album, anything that really Nine Inch Nails was about.
Right.
You know, like,
but this is in the shadow of the enormous success of Downward Spiral, right?
Yeah, so, but they won a Grammy for Wish from Broken. And I did read, like, there's a quote where he said, like, I think this is the first time a Grammy has gone to a song that says the word fist fuck in it. Which when I was
probably 12, the first time,
yeah, I had no idea what a fist fuck was when I was 12 years old, but. You know, at that age, you're just kind of happy to be listening to music that says the F word. You know, it felt dangerous. I had no idea what that meant. It probably took a few years to wrap my head around that little nugget.
Amazing. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, as I said earlier, I think it's a messy masterpiece. I'm always a fan of, I am a person that gravitates towards that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, there are several movies that I love that people are just like, I don't fucking get it. As there are for you too, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And albums like that too. And I think that this album, I think I mentioned in that Stereo Gum review a little bit too, of just sort of the immersion of it, the swing of it. I love a big swing. I love yeah. an attempt at, you know, a big double album. That I imagine for those fans must have been like this, salivating at the opportunity, and then and found themselves listening to something very that was confused. Deeply challenging and yeah. very hard. You know, I think it's you know, a noble effort, and I really do. I'm sure I will listen to it again over the years. It feels like an important album, and it feels like in a year of, you know, Britney Spears and Korn and Red Hot Chili Peppers, and I mean,
yeah, that was all a big sorts album, of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, California Cage was an enormous album. That's another band that feels like, yeah. But it's weird and it's great and it's wonderful that this album came out amongst all of that, and you know, that a major label put a full throated effort behind promoting it and mm-hmm. and all that. I think it's really incredible. And I think too, you know, what I like about being able to talk about this album and albums like it are being able to see a turning point in a band and being like, you can see a definite moment where it all changes for Trent. And yeah. I think that's really fascinating in and of itself. But thank you so much for talking about this album.
Yeah,
for coming on here. I want everyone, again, I'm mentioning Letters End, which is Scott's music project. Let's call it that. Yeah. It's on all your streaming sites. It's also on Bandcamp. Please support this amazing music. And thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Phil. So much fun.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. 1999, podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.